Howdy, I'm Gordon Maples. For followers of my work at the Misanthropy Movie Blog, today is going to be a little different. Recently, I had the pleasure of speaking at the 2018 Con of Thrones, the largest fan-run Game of Thrones convention. My topic was highly related to some of the work I've been doing here at the blog, analyzing fictional portrayals of higher education in my Ivy on Celluloid series. What follows here is a loose adaptation of the presentation I gave there, which took a look at the Order of the Maesters from Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire. Without further ado, here is Maesters and Mortarboards: Connections Between Education in Westeros and Real-World History. Let's start with some introductions. I'm Gordon Maples. I have a bachelor's degree in history, an in-progress MED in higher education, and a pretty low-traffic film blog called Misanthropy. In fact, if you've somehow stumbled across this recording, there's probably a 50% chance that you are a spam bot. If so, I appreciate your enduring support. One of the things I have been writing about a lot recently is the intersection of my varied interests: film, history, and higher education. My Ivy on Celluloid series at Misanthropy is dedicated to analyzing the depictions of higher education on film, and trying to dig up historical bases for those portrayals. This brings me to Game of Thrones. While I was doing research for Ivy on Celluloid, my significant other was watching through Game of Thrones for the first time. As I was watching along with her, I couldn't help but think about the mysterious Order of the Maesters. While it isn't a perfect one-to-one comparison, the Maesters are roughly equivalent to a medieval education and research institution in Westeros. But how far does it diverge from its real-world counterparts, both in history and in the present day? Before we go any further, it is worth throwing a content notice on this. Things are going to get a bit dark, particularly as I get into the history of unethical experimentation. Also, there is a non-zero chance that this is going to get super boring. Right about the time I get to the organization charts, you'll probably be wishing you had your time back. Now that that's out of the way, let's get to some Maesters 101. The following text is paraphrased from a special feature on the Maesters from the Game of Thrones Season 1 DVD. The great stone city of Old Town is home to the Citadel, where men and boys from throughout the kingdoms come to receive their training as Maesters. Maesters serve as scholars, healers, and advisors to the nobility of the Seven Kingdoms. They dedicate their lives to serving the realm and are sworn to occupy a neutral position when it comes to power and politics. A maester renounces his family name and takes a vow of celibacy. He is assigned to a castle or keep, but a maester's allegiance is to the realm and not to any one family. His badge of office is a great chain forged of links from different metals which he wears about his neck. It is a reminder of his role as a servant to the realm, and is never to be removed. A maester forges his chain with study, and each link indicates a mastery of a different kind of learning. Maesters also breed, train, and maintain carrier ravens that deliver messages throughout the land. Service as a maester is a noble calling and one of vital importance. Some even refer to the order as the Knights of the Mind. Now that you have the basics, let's look at the origins of this order, according to the Wiki of Ice and Fire. Most accounts credit the foundation of the Citadel to Prince Paramore the Twisted. Paramore invited numerous scholars, including wise men, teachers, priests, healers, singers, wizards, alchemists, and sorcerers, to Old Town. After Paramore's death, his brother, King Uragon, granted land alongside the Honeywine to Paramore's pets, who developed the tract into the Maester's Citadel. So, basically, a long time ago, a prince of the High Towers got a bunch of dorks together to hang out and think about stuff. Then, after he died, the king granted the order some land on which they built the Citadel. I will point out the variety of the dorks, though. The fact that the wizards, alchemists, sorcerers, and priests were all involved is really fascinating, as I'll get into later. Before I get back to the origins of the order, let's take a second to talk about the nomenclature of the institutional hierarchy. Doesn't that sound neat? Here we go. There are six key titles in the Order of the Maesters that merit discussing: Novice, Acolyte, Maester, Archmaester, Seneschal, and Grand Maester. When a student comes to the Citadel, they immediately become a novice, until such time as they prove their proficiency in a field to the satisfaction of the preeminent expert in that field, the Archmaester. At that time, they receive a chain link of a medal corresponding to their field of study. I'll get more into that curriculum later. Once a novice has earned a chain link, they become an acolyte. Until they collect enough chain links to make a full chain, a distinction that isn't exactly made clear, then they remain an acolyte indefinitely. Apparently, a good number of students at the Citadel never move beyond this level of acolyte, either for lack of ability or lack of interest. Prince Oberyn Martell, for example, is technically an acolyte, because he earned a link for mastering poisons. However, he never intended to complete his chain to become a maester. Should an acolyte earn the requisite number of links, they are made to go through a ritual, in which they are tasked with lighting a glass candle over the course of a night in an empty room. This task, however, is not meant to be completed. More on this later. Then, they take a vow of celibacy and service to the realm, and formally become a maester. They are assigned to a paying house and serve the lord of the keep to which they are assigned. At the time of the events of Game of Thrones, there are 300 active maesters. If a maester proves to be the preeminent expert in a field of study, they can be appointed to the title of Archmaester. Archmaesters are located at the Citadel, and teach classes in their specialty to acolytes and novices, and also serve in the Conclave, the governing body of the Citadel and the Order of the Maesters. This body selects the Grand Maester and determines the changes of the seasons. At the time of the events of Game of Thrones, there are 21 Archmaesters. Archmaesters, for the record, are my favorite group of people in Game of Thrones. They basically try to do as little bureaucratic work as possible, even with their very limited responsibilities as the Conclave. The perfect example of this is the selection of the Seneschal, the executive officer of the Conclave. In an annual ceremony, the Archmaesters randomly draw stones to select which of them will serve in this role. The winner slash loser in this lottery has to be the Seneschal, and actually do work for a year. They so dislike the responsibility and power that they basically draw straws for it. The loser becomes the most powerful maester. It is basically counter to every other system of power and thought in Westeros. It's amazing. The last maester-related title is the Grand Maester. When I first read A Song of Ice and Fire, I assumed the Grand Maester was a pretty powerful guy. Like, he must be the top maester, right? He works directly for the king. As it so happens, the Grand Maester has no power over the other maesters. He is essentially a permanent emissary assigned by the Conclave to have the king's ear. Even better, the Conclave has a rich history of picking the actual oldest and least effectual dude available to assign to this role. Prior to the appointment of Pycelle to Grand Maester, they had appointed 3 consecutive octogenarians, all of whom died in the service of the same king. King Aegon V had to specifically request that they stop shipping him old and dying guys to sit on his council. At that point is when they sent him Pycelle, who has since become yet another octogenarian. Now that we've dug into the bureaucracy and titles of the maesters, let's look at real life for a second. If you thought Westeros was complicated, they ain't got nothing on us. We have undergraduate students, graduate students, assistant professors, associate professors, full professors, department chairs, academic deans, provosts, presidents, and that's just to name a few. To the best I can gather, a novice is a pretty close parallel to an undergraduate student, who is yet to earn a degree. An acolyte covers everything from a graduate student who has earned an undergrad degree, to potentially an assistant professor. This is because the tenure process, which stands between the titles of assistant and associate professor, is a pretty close parallel to the oath taken by the maesters in their permanent assignment to a keep. It isn't a perfect one-to-one parallel, but it is pretty close. An archmaester is probably close to a full professor, academic dean, or department chair, as these titles are all reserved for experts in their fields and typically have a degree of bureaucratic responsibility. The seneschal, for lack of a better equivalent, is pretty close to a vice president, provost, or a president of a university. To visualize all of this, let's compare organization charts. I warned you about this. Even a moderately sized university in the modern age has an organization structure that defies the limitations of a page. Most publicly available organization charts for universities are segmented by vice presidential division, of which there are typically a good number. The organization chart of Southern Methodist University, a roughly 12,000 student institution in Dallas, Texas, fills a dense page with just the provost structure alone, even with omitting department chairs. We're talking really tiny text here. That's even on the small side of a large university. Ohio State University, for example, is 5 times the size of SMU. That's because modern universities are massive institutions, with tons of people in positions making up cogs and gears. For the sake of comparison, let me describe my improvised organizational chart for the Maesters. If you want a visual of this, check out the text companion for this post on Misanthropy. At the bottom, there are 300 total Maesters. Above that are the 21 Archmaesters that make up the Conclave. One of the Archmaesters is the unlucky one having to do actual work as the Seneschal, due to losing the lottery. Off to the side is the Grand Maester, denoted by a red box emblazoned with the word OLD. Unlike the SMU chart that I mentioned before, this is the entire organization. There are, essentially, only 2 tiers of power, unless you count the Seneschal on his own. It is a pretty simple organization structure that is very easy to explain. It even easily fits in a single image, without leaving anyone out. It turns out that the Maester's disdain of bureaucracy has created a pretty lean system here. On to the next topic, let's talk about church. Remember when I mentioned the collection of dorks that made up the original Maesters? One of those dork categories was priests. While the Order of the Maesters is not explicitly a religious order, this is a bit of a nod to one of their closest real-life counterparts, the monastic schools of the medieval age. Here's a quick excerpt I dug up, which talks about the role of the monastic schools in education in the medieval age. Through the mid-11th century, monastic schools were the most stable force in education. Much of the school's curriculum focused on teaching them to read and write in Latin, and preparing them to join the ranks of the church. These monasteries became great repositories of knowledge, in that many of the books of the day were copied by hand in monastic scriptoria and stored in their libraries. If some of that reminds you of anything, it should. The Citadel Library is definitely inspired by the libraries of monastic schools, and the curriculum of the Maesters' training is almost all focused on training more Maesters. You don't have to look far to see more quasi-religious elements to the Maesters. I mean, why else would they require celibacy? I see this as a pretty clear nod to their real-life origins. Even their conclave is based on Catholic bureaucracy. Likewise, their aesthetics are pretty clearly monkish. In the world of Ice and Fire, George R.R. Martin essentially decided to split the real-life institution of the church into 2 independent parts, the Faith of the Seven and the Order of the Maesters. And honestly, it kind of makes sense. It was around this age and reality that the experts and scholars from the monastic schools split off into their own institutions, the early universities, like the University of Paris. As you might recall, the Maesters were granted land and recognition by the crown. In reality, the orders had to organize themselves into guilds and then form universities on their own. Alright, let's get on to some symbolism. When you think of symbols of academia, you probably picture a few different things. Maybe a diploma? One of those funny hats? A mortarboard? A tassel? If you are Finnish, you might picture a sword and a top hat. There's definitely a few different ones out there. Regardless of what you associate with academia in the real world, the Maesters absolutely have reality beat. On top of their iconic chains, the physical embodiment of their mastered arts, Archmaesters also get a ring, a rod, and a face mask, forged of the metal of their specialty. Archmaester Ebrose, for example, gets a rod, face mask, and ring forged of silver for his full regalia. Awesome. Speaking of chains and medals, Let's get into the curriculum of the Maesters. As I mentioned, the chain is the physical embodiment of a Maester's completed curriculum. The medals of the links indicate what they have learned. In the real world, the closest thing to this chain is a transcript, which isn't nearly as dramatic or visually compelling. It makes it much harder for everyone to know just how many degrees and how much debt you have. The curriculum of the Maesters is intriguing, particularly in how it contrasts the history of education in reality. The subjects that we know are taught in the Citadel include medicine, astronomy, warcraft, poisons, higher mysteries, math and economics, ravenry, history, herb lore, and castle building, each of which have their own medals assigned to them. However, this is not exhaustive. Again, we know there are 21 Archmaesters, each with a specialty. However, there may be more than one Archmaester per subject. That detail has never been clarified. This contrasts pretty starkly with reality. For a very long time, the curriculum was limited to the Trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and the Quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. For the most part, these subjects were meant to provide a general, rounded education. However, in time, many became frustrated that colleges weren't preparing people for practical, career-based knowledge. In the United States, populist pressure for technical and agricultural education eventually led to the formation of A&M colleges in the late 1800s, which focused on practical education that readied students for specific careers. The purpose of education continues to be debated today, with people deriding and/or defending the merits and demerits of liberal arts and/or technical college ad nauseum. However, the Maesters managed to skip over this conflict entirely. It didn't take a cultural revolution to get them to teach practical knowledge alongside a traditional curriculum. They just sort of did it organically. Now, I want to touch on one of my favorite Maester-related topics, scholasticism and the supernatural. To set this up, I want to talk about Maester Luwin. In season 1 of the show, there is a great scene where Luwin talks to Bran Stark about magic and the higher mysteries. He reveals that he studied these subjects at the Citadel, one of the very few Maesters who did. He reminisces about his youth as a dreamer, and tells Bran, with a tinge of disappointment, that magic, if it ever existed, is now gone from the world. This is representative of how the Maesters regard magic as a whole. They not only don't give it credence, but they actively discourage research into it, and treat it explicitly like fantasy. While there is an Archmaester of the higher mysteries, very few students study it, and those who do are siphoned of their enthusiasm for it. Luwin is a good example of this. As a young man, he dreamed of magic, but his studies dispelled him of this fantastic notions. But you might be curious, why do the Maesters dismiss magic? This is because they have a basis in the logic of scholasticism, the method of thought that gave rise to the scientific method and modern scientific thought and reasoning. Scholasticism was practiced in medieval schools as well. Back then, it used techniques of logical inquiry to link Christian revelation, church doctrine, and the mysteries of the natural universe into a deeper and more reasonable understanding. The scholastics drew upon logical analysis to establish a common method of inquiry and attempt to reason their way to a logical conclusion. We are led to believe that the magic and supernatural, as it exists in A Song of Ice and Fire, does not have a basis in logic, and is therefore beyond the scope of scholasticism. This is true for reality as well. The Academy is very focused on the observable, material, and real. If you want to put that to the test, ask a field biologist at random about Sasquatch and their opinions on him. Or ask any given astrophysicist about alien abduction stories. The difference between reality and A Song of Ice and Fire is that, in Martin's world, magic was only dormant, not non-existent. Beyond this analysis, this is just good world-building. The non-magical Westeros we are introduced to is more believable and tangible, and characters start exactly as skeptical as we are of the old stories and legends that seem beyond belief. However, this disdain for the supernatural leads us to one of my favorite tinfoil hat theories from A Song of Ice and Fire, the Grand Maester Conspiracy. Remember how I said that I love the Archmaesters? Well, Archmaester Morwen is my favorite of the lot by far. The Grandmaester Conspiracy is based on a conversation between Morwen and Sam, in which Morwen reveals that the Maesters are actively trying to rid magic from the world and were responsible for its past dormancy, because they killed all of the Targaryen dragons. My take on the Grandmaester Conspiracy that Morwen proposes is that there is nothing to substantiate it. Personally, I think he was just messing with Sam, the newest novice of the Citadel. Keep in mind, the conversation happens as soon as the two are introduced. I just can't wrap my head around how else to read that interaction. This is a strange old man trying to rattle the rookie, and I absolutely love him for it. In any case, suspicion of the Maesters is not unique to Morwen's crackpottery. The common folk, for good reason, aren't particularly fond of the Maesters. They have a bit of a reputation as servants of high houses of not caring for commoners, particularly when it comes to medical care. Even many high-born folks are suspicious of them due to the perceived concealment of their true identities. I dare not even trust my maester. They are supposed to put aside old loyalties when they don their chains, but I cannot forget that Maester Theomore was born a Lannister of Lannisport. Wyman Manderly, Davos IV, A Dance with Dragons. Likewise, the Maesters having total control over communications has led many to suspect that they manipulate information to their own ends, as best serves their agenda. The Maesters read and write our letters, even for such lords as cannot read themselves, and who can say for a certainty that they are not twisting the words for their own ends? Barbary Dustin, The Prince of Winterfell, A Dance with Dragons. This is not unlike a lot of populist and right-wing criticisms of higher education today. It isn't uncommon to hear allegations that higher education institutions brainwash students or have a liberal agenda, or that they don't teach real or accurate information. So, the Maesters deal with a pretty similar issue of public suspicion here. However, the Maesters aren't quite as elitist as they initially sound. While they are definitely sexist and have a preference for highborn students, they don't turn away common folks who wish to pursue knowledge. Boys and young men from all over Westeros come to study, learn, and forge their chains at the Citadel. There is no age requirement, and despite the prejudice of the Archmaesters to status of birth, males of every social class are allowed to forge their chain. As such, baseborns, bastards, younger children of lords, and even royalty can study together at the Citadel. A Wiki of Ice and Fire, Maesters. For a society that is so dramatically feudal and divided by class, the Maesters allowing commoners access to education is pretty unexpected. It also makes for an interesting comparison with reality. In antiquity, education was implicated in the structures of power, and specifically in training the rulers to rule and the ruled to be ruled. It was largely exclusive as a process, with birth and class rather than ability as the operative criteria for determining who would be given training and knowledge. It created the empowered as empowered and the subjects as subjects. YL2, Education in Greek and Roman Antiquity. Even today, education institutions are immensely elitist. Increasing access to quality education for women, racial minorities, and those of lower economic means is a huge focus and issue in education today. A huge part of that, however, is due to the cost of education, which easily stretches into the tens of thousands of dollars for a huge number of students seeking higher education. In Westeros, in contrast, the best education in the world, taught by the top masters in any given field, is completely free. The Maesters charge a fee for their services to all of the great and aspiring houses that house a Maester, which is all of them, and collect taxes from the citizens of Old Town. All of that money is put into the running of the Citadel and the education of novices and acolytes. Basically, the richest of Westerosi society subsidize the education of any males who wish to seek it. It is socialism with swords, y'all. Now, let's get to the dark stuff. Qyburn is the current Hand of the Queen, and thus is currently one of the most powerful people in Westeros. He is also a former Maester, stripped of his chain due to a series of unethical medical experiments centered on how to subvert death, executed on unwilling participants and prisoners. So, there's a long, long history of unethical experimentation in reality. There's a whole Wikipedia page just focused on unethical human experimentation in the United States. To be fair, this is important information for people to know. Some terrible things have been done in the name of science and research, both inside and outside of the academy. Look up the Tuskegee experiments, the Stanford Prison Experiment, and Project MKUltra, just as a start. It is a depressing Wikipedia hole to go down, but an important one. I want to mention two specific examples here, because of their similarities to Qyburn. The first of these is a man named Dr. Leo Stanley. Dr. Leo Stanley served as San Quentin Prison's chief surgeon for nearly four decades. Throughout, Stanley fixated on curing various crises of manhood. Under Stanley's scalpel, prisoners became subjects in a series of eugenic treatments, ranging from sterilization to implanting testicular substances from executed prisoners, and also goats, into San Quentin inmates. Stanley was convinced that his research would rejuvenate aged men, control crime, and limit the reproduction of the unfit. From The Strange Career of Leo Stanley, Remaking Manhood and Medicine at San Quentin State Penitentiary. Dr. Leo Stanley was a eugenicist. He believed that action should be taken to purify and improve humanity through genetic means. For the most part, that means he was a super racist, hated people with disabilities, and was an all-around asshat. To these ends, he used his position as a prison surgeon to do a variety of experiments on non-consenting prisoners, including what was described above, implanting goat testes into people and forcing sterilization among them. He was, not unlike Qyburn, a man who was absolutely sure that what he was doing was right, and for the best of humanity. He also abused his position to conduct wildly inappropriate experiments. Unlike Qyburn, he was never stripped of his degree. In fact, he was lauded by many, and worked for decades conducting these experiments. Another example I want to look at is Dr. Julius Hallervorden, a Nazi. On October 28, 1940, Julius Hallervorden, a professor of brain anatomy, went to an extermination center in the Brandenburg Jail. He was present when 50 children were murdered by carbon monoxide. He dissected their brains immediately after. After the war, he became subdirector of the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research in Frankfurt, Germany. There, he published many papers on those brains. Certainly, it was not Hallervorden's idea to kill the children. He did not open the carbon monoxide valve, but to profit from the murder in such a way, Hallervorden's science seems to be excellent. This makes the situation even worse in my eyes. From Dark Medicine, Rationalizing Unethical Medical Research, by LeFleur, Bohm, and Shimazono. Just to recap, Dr. Hallervorden was a Nazi, was present for the murder of 50 children, and then immediately dissected their brains. For years after the war, he continued to publish on his child murder brains, and even held a prestigious post at a brain research institute in Germany. His contributions to brain research are still defended by many today, despite his complicity in and benefiting from the murder of children. I bring this up, in part, because people justify his actions in much the way Qyburn justifies his own. Also, it is worth noting the contrast between the treatment of Qyburn with the treatments of both Stanley and Hallervorden. Qyburn lost his chain for his actions. Stanley and Hallervorden are still defended today, and got to retire with their degrees. I will say that there are thorough institutional review boards at universities now that aim to prevent unethical experimentation in the academy. Still, that doesn't undo past actions, and defenders of atrocious experimentation practices are still out there. However, it is hard not to note how much more swiftly the fictional, medieval-era maesters dealt with ethical violations than the real institutions. This concludes my rundown of the Order of the Maesters, and how they relate to the real-world history of the Academy and research. This all may have been interesting to you, or it might not have been. I hope it was the former, but if it was the latter, that's tough for you. I did warn you, after all.